I wanted to start with just an example. Most people are referring to the current generation as the me generation. I hear that a lot. But that's not the first generation that had that term assigned to them. In 1969, you'll probably remember Frank Sinatra recorded and released a song called My Way. Remember that song? I actually heard a woman change the words to that to God's Way and sing it for special music. But everybody was thinking of Frankie, so it was kind of weird. But it became a huge hit at the time. Not so much in the States. So I think it hit in the 20s on the Billboard charts, but especially in England, it ran as number one for a long time for some reason. It is still, I looked this up, it's still the most popular song for people in England to play at funerals. Because it's from the perspective of a guy who's nearing the end of his life, looking ahead to death. He's looking back at his life very proudly with this idea that he did it his own way. Others have since performed that version or other versions of that song. Elvis Presley did one in Vegas. Chris Mann, even Sid Vicious and the Sex Pistols recorded a version of My Way. I wouldn't recommend that you listen to it, though. It's filled with vulgarities, as you can imagine. The song was originally a French tune. I don't know if you knew that. It was actually a tune in French. Paul Anka heard the tune, didn't think it was anything remarkable, but thought he could do something with it with the right performer and a changing of the lyrics. So he went over to France, negotiated the purchase of the tune at a very low rate, low amount, because it didn't do too well in France. But he later would admit that he wrote the song specifically for Sinatra. He actually met with him. Paul Anka met with Frank Sinatra and worked through some of the idea behind it. As though he thought the tune was unremarkable, but he said with the right performer and the right lyrics, he felt there was something that he could make it work. So many consider it to be Sinatra's signature song, but the timing of its release was also significant. Paul Anka would later say, a quote, we were in the me generation. And Frank became the guy for me to use to say that, unquote. Now, it's just not from a standpoint of who Frank Sinatra was, but from his perspective, how he was respected within Hollywood and the recording studios and so on, is a gift and ability within music and also within the theater. He won an Academy Award. The song, in the wording, appealed to its market base. And because of that, it became very popular. For many, the song became a validation for relying on oneself and no one else. And though it commended personal accountability, many admired the self-assurance of trusting only in one's self. By no means does a song impel a culture, but cultures have a way of adopting or selecting their own defining themes. The influence of the me generation at that time, in 1969, was obviously the 60s. It was the coming to age of the baby boomer generation. Since that time, the concept of me and me only has grown exponentially. And this admiration for self-reliance and individualism has suppressed respect for a very strong and important biblical principle, the wisdom of seeking advice and counsel. I'd like to turn to a couple of scriptures here. Proverbs 11 and verse 14 first. You could turn there with me if you'd like. Put up a PowerPoint. Don't use it. I'm learning to. These scriptures are just a few in the Bible, especially in the book of Proverbs, that talk about the importance of wisdom, or getting wisdom. Where there is no counsel, the people fail or fall, depending on your translation. But in the multitude of counselors, there is safety. Safety at a treacherous time is a very, very important principle. And we live at the end time, as we were discussing in this morning's Bible study. And the way this world is going and what we know is ahead of us, as prophecy points to, is a very treacherous time to live. So especially today, safety is important. But unfortunately, most don't seek counsel in the decisions they make in their life. In fact, they've been conditioned by society to think that they shouldn't do that, that there's some kind of cowardice or fear in that. Proverbs 15:22 says that without counsel, plans go awry. But in the multitude of counselors, they are established. The multitude of counselors. And not just friends. We'll see this poor example earlier of somebody who relied on his friends and ignored more wise counsel. Not even just family. Go to those who will, and we'll learn this as a basic principle as well, go to those who would potentially disagree with you. That's a level of wisdom in and of itself. Proverbs 20 and verse 18, plans are established by counsel. By wise counsel wage war. War is, of course, one of the most devastating, detrimental decisions any country or king can enter into. Don't ever do that. Leaders know this without getting a great deal of counsel. Those who do not usually wreak havoc and destruction on the entire planet. Proverbs 24, verse 6, for by wise counsel you will wage your own war, and in a multitude of counselors there is safety. Again, these are just a few. We'll touch on a few more as we go through this. But the importance of finding, seeking wise counsel is something that's kind of been lost. It started before the me generation of the 1960s, but it certainly is a problem on steroids now. If you like a specific purpose statement in your messages, the message is good leaders have good counselors. Good leaders have good counselors. One of the first things that we have to do before we seek counsel is to admit that we need counsel. We were talking this morning about the return of Jesus Christ, one of the core fundamental doctrines of the United Church of God. And we're talking about how what happens after Jesus Christ returns to the earth. Someone mentioned, I think it was Tallulah mentioned, first fruits, that we are going to be called upon to oversee operations in ways and in operational activities or things that we would have to administer over that where we have little or no experience. What do you know about sewer systems? What do you know about electricity that will be needed? What do you know about planting and growing? And I don't know if you know this, but we've got some pretty sharp resources right here in this room about those things. I'll let you find them. But these are the kinds of things that we're going to have to help people with that come out of the devastating Great Tribulation. How will we learn how to handle whatever responsibilities we will be given? And I'm not saying you need to go out and study absolutely everything that we're going to need to know. But the mindset of knowing that we need help, instead of just making the decision for ourselves, that has to play in the world tomorrow. Otherwise, it doesn't work any other way. We will need lots of advice. And it shouldn't be a demeaning thing for us to as a God being, going to somebody that's still physical potentially, but had great success in farming before the destruction of this age, and ask them, counsel them, with them, maybe even set them in a position of authority and work with them and through them. We'll need lots of advice, lots of good advice. But we will first need to recognize that we need help to see a matter more clearly. And that's one of the first things that we have to learn in this age. This is more difficult, though, than we may realize. Think of the President of the United States. And everyone that's taken the office. Being President of the United States, he has a very large group of advisors, not just within his cabinet, but elsewhere, many other places, to give him recommendations on various matters. They are experts in their field in most cases who can help him to kind of anticipate how people will react to various decisions. They help him anticipate questions that he could be asked so that he's ready to give the answers, so he's not on the spot with nothing to say. They even advise him on how to dress, how to talk, how to stand, how to walk, because all those things play when people are looking and evaluating their leaders. Yet he still seems to get into trouble. As the leaders of the world tomorrow, we should learn from this now. Look at Proverbs chapter 12 here and verse 15. Another scripture that should ring true, not just in our memories from knowledge, but in seeing when we have fallen short in making decisions because we did not recognize that we needed help before we did so. Proverbs 12 and verse 15 says, the way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but he who heeds counsel is wise. Well, to heed counsel, you first have to learn to seek it. And again, the way of a fool is right in his own eyes. He won't do that. When we think that we know all we need to know, we won't ask anyone and we won't listen to anyone. That hubris, which has been developed in this age, we must address in this age, or we won't be fit to rule in the kingdom. How many decisions do we make without considering this one question? How would someone else view this action? How would someone else view this action? It's a basic step of wisdom. Doesn't mean that you're trying to impress anyone else or manipulate anyone else. But out of love and respect for everyone else, how often do we ask that question? Or do we just do what we want to do because it feels good? That's another 1960s line, if it feels good, do it. In 1 Corinthians 8 and verse 2, tell you what, let's turn there, because that comes right after another strong statement to us about avoiding hubris and what we think we know. 1 Corinthians 8 and verse 1. Now concerning things offered to idols, we know that we have all knowledge. In other words, the word of God has been revealed to us. We have access to all gnosis, all opportunity to learn. Knowledge, gnosis, puffs up, makes us proud. Absent of love, though. Love edifies. The motivation for our learning and growing in that knowledge should be love. And if anyone thinks that he knows anything, he knows nothing as he ought to know. The wise are wise because they know their limitations. It's not a matter of intellect. It's a matter of how do you apply what you know. Look at Proverbs 26 here. Proverbs 26, verses 13 through 16. Proverbs 26 is verses 13 through 16. The lazy man says, there is a lion in the road. A fierce lion is in the streets. As a door turns on its hinges, so does the lazy man on his bed. The lazy man buries his hand in the bowl. It wearies him to bring it back to his mouth. The lazy man is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who can answer sensibly. Most individuals who avoid work think that they are wise by being able to do so, and they lose the whole understanding and growth of character that is in doing work and applying oneself in work. This skill and ability to accomplish something builds character that they never build. The lazy, though, they find every reason not to act. Seven wise men can offer sound advice to someone who is lazy, but they won't listen to it. They've established a pattern of avoiding work and will continue to do so. Look at Proverbs 19. Proverbs 19, verses 20 and 21. Listen to counsel and receive instruction, that you may be wise in your latter days. For those especially who are in their youth, this is extremely important in your latter days. When you read through Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and you listen to an old man telling you in your youth to establish a relationship with God early, that's a wise act, because in your latter days, your patterns of thinking won't be cluttered by wrong decisions. The living that you do then will not be hurt by poor decisions that you've made in this age prior to getting old. There are many plans in a man's heart. Nevertheless, it's the Lord's counsel that will stand. Wisdom takes years to build. It's not something you can read. It's not something that someone can teach you. Wisdom is right knowledge and application and making right choices. And one of the major purposes of life is to grow in wisdom, as this verse explains. Verse 21 especially. When we build our plans in line with God's counsel, we make God our chief counselor. That's the first counselor we should be selecting. And we will learn before God and all his greatness and goodness how we should choose. And we will have some major decisions in our lives. And the bigger those decisions are, the more we should see that we need help. Education and career. What field of study have you chosen and why? Is it because it's fun and enjoyable? Or have you sought counsel to find out what your skills and abilities are, including taking tests to understand what your skills and abilities are, talking to your parents who know you better than anyone else, not just your friends. I know some who choose a college to go to simply because their friends are going there. Is that a wise decision? Certainly not. The choice of college, what company you will work for, all should be dependent upon a wise counsel that you sought. What about something as simple as buying a car? Well, you may think it's simple. Is the most important thing in your mind the fact that it's blue? There are a lot of things to consider. There are a lot of consumer resources that are available on how much service the car has taken, how reliable it is, what's the resale value, so many other things that need to be looked into before you buy a car. Buying a house is even more important, a much bigger expense. There's so much to learn there. How does a mortgage work? What is a title? What do you need to look for in a home inspection? What's important and what is less important? You may like the color. You may like its location, which certainly is important. You may like the living patterns within the house and so on. But what about basic stuff that resides in the utility room? Most people tend to avoid. But the furnace and your well and your water and your electricity, that's the guts of the house. What do you know about those kinds of things? And how do you make a decision as to what you buy? There's all kinds of ways to go wrong there. Marriage, huge, huge decision. Probably next to your relationship with God, the most important decision you'll make in your life that will affect this life. Most couples prepare for the wedding, and they're all focused on that walking down the aisle. I know I'm going to be walking Chelsea down the aisle 2 weeks from now. And her mind is just occupied with that. But she spent the last 4 years kind of preparing for the marriage. And I hope she's learned what she needs to. But she's going to have to move forward in her own wisdom. Certainly will be there and be resources for her. But she's got to make the decision. It's wise to get counsel before you commit to marry. And not to follow emotions or attractions only. We'll talk a bit about that later. Counsel from family, again, who know you better than anyone, and counsel as well from the family of the one you're considering marrying. Certainly friends that you respect, especially those who have been through that process. The ministry is also very helpful and skilled in many cases to be able to help. Other experts, we use a tool called Prepare and Enrich. It's a survey that helps the couple to learn how close they are in certain aspects that are going to help them. Personality styles, expectations for money and finances, family differences, and so on, so that they can talk about that and prepare a little bit better. That's developed, actually, with over 250,000 couples, and they keep adding to it every year, the more who take it. Marriage affects so many other aspects of our lives. You may not recognize this. You may think it's your decision and his or her decision only, but if the more people you get involved with that decision, again, people that will help you with it, the easier it'll be for you. Family, friends, all of your relationships will be determined by that going forward. Your spouse's friends will become yours. Your friends will become your spouse's, or not. That's a decision you'll have to work through. It'll affect where you work and even what you do for a job. It'll affect your financial health going forward. One of the biggest causes of poverty is divorce. I don't know if you knew that. Where are you going to bank? How are you going to bank? What will you invest in? How will you prepare for retirement? Physical health, where and how you will live. All of that is determined on your choice to marry. Child rearing is a big one. When we talk about that, we'll be going through the more details on that in the parenting courses that we're going through. But child rearing is huge. And my wife and I were blessed with many willing counselors in the church, within family, and so on, the ministry over the years. And we dated for 3.5 years, and it was 7 years after that before we actually had our first child. I was pretty old at the time, but she was pretty young, and, you were still 30, right? You were 30 years old. So we were older parents, and I come from a long line of older parents, and I see my father and his father and his father as these sages. Well, they weren't. They were just older. And they were more experienced. They didn't fly off the handle as much. They knew how to handle certain situations. And I think it benefited me tremendously, especially as a father. A number told us and shared with us where they made mistakes. I've had so many people come up to me afterwards and say, "Boy, I wish I would have known what I know now 30 years ago." And they're perfectly, most people are perfectly willing to share with you the mistakes that they've made if you ask in the right setting, at the right timing, with the right respect. Parenting is a lifetime of learning. Every stage you go through, you'll never stop being a parent once you have children. There are just different stages of it. They're all enjoyable, but they all need their elements of wisdom. That's why we're doing this parenting from the Tree of Life thing with some of our younger families, and I think everyone's finding it helpful. What about things like wills? How are you establishing where your property goes when and if you die? Living trusts, what are they? Limited family partnerships, what are they? You need counsel on these things. What about health issues? You know, some members avoid professional advice, avoid going to doctors. I guess I can understand that. Others, though, put their confidence in quacks. I've seen this too many times over the years. I'm not saying that any alternative treatment is, but I know some individuals will only go to a doctor who will tell them what they want to hear. That's not wise. Diet is extremely important. How do you restructure your diet? Most simply follow their parents' diets, whatever they were, or what you liked when you were a child. You know, I could eat two whole pizzas at a sitting up until I was about 40. Then I started having stomach problems. Go figure. I said, "Renee, I don't understand. I'm starting to have stomach pains and heartburn and so on. What did you just eat?" Pizza. How much? Two pieces? No. Two whole pizzas? I could eat three Burger King Whoppers at a sitting. I mean, most of our young people can do that and not bat an eye or gain a pound. But there's going to be a point in time when that will change. And if you think the only thing that you need for the rest of your life is meat and cheese, think again. And some of us older people who've been through that can help you see why it's important to have a balanced diet. Nutrition is important, but sometimes it's not what you eat, it's what's eating you that is important with respect to your health. And you can get priceless help for that as well. For all these decisions and so many more, a good counselor is priceless. So, once we recognize the needs that we will have for counsel and advice, part two, how do we find a good counselor? We'll give you a couple of steps here before we go into some scriptures. For young people, start with your parents. I know that's not very popular. I know that's not very chic. You may think they are lacking in a great deal, and they are. They would be the first to say they're not perfect, and they don't know everything, but you know what? Most will know much more than you think they do. What was it, Hubbard that made the statement that he was surprised how much his father learned between his own 18th and 24th birthday or something like that? In those short 6 years, boy, he became really incredibly wise. Well, he was always wise. It's just sometimes we don't get a chance to see it. Young people especially, no one loves you more than your parents. And regardless of how much you think your friends know, your parents know more. I heard a comment in the camp video about how important it is to have a good friends as a support group. In your relationship with God. And I don't discount it. It's a very important thing. But I wonder how much support Abraham had, the father of the faithful. He had a good father, Terah, and he understood God and had a relationship with God as an individual. I'm not saying that you don't need friends. All I'm saying is that God has given you a support group in your parents. You won't understand all that they can help you with until you have more life experience, and perhaps sometimes before you fall flat on your face and do it your way. If you cooperate with them now, it'll prove it to be much more beneficial than you can imagine in the future, your future life. Whatever their faults, they are the most likely to give you good advice in what you should do in life. They are most likely to help you when you're in trouble and have your best interests at heart. This is why God says in that commandment, honor your father and mother. He says it for a reason. He says that your days may be long upon the earth. This is the safety that he has given us. And he's placed all of us in loving families, for the most part, that can provide that. And if you don't have that in your own home, you can find that within the structure of the church. He's preserved that within the church as well. Secondarily, look at credentials. Look at credentials. Solid credentials that someone has, or a license that they have with respect to being a professional, can indicate at least some basic understanding of the subject. So look at their credentials. Where were they trained? Has the state licensed them? And what have they been doing? How long have they been doing? And so on. Some credentials are better than others. Credentials don't guarantee success, but they are a very good start. So look and see what their credentials are. What's their background? What's their training? What's their experience? And measure one versus the other. Don't go to one just because he's closer to home. Or don't go to another just because you get along with them better. A wise person will seek counsel that they need. Number three. Look for a solid track record. Even experienced doctors can disagree on a diagnosis or a treatment plan. Most will tell you that it's wise to get a second opinion. Some won't. Some will almost be offended by that. But there's nothing wrong with getting a second or even a third opinion, if you can. That's multitude of counselors and safety. Medical doctors don't always approach problems the same way that, say, a chiropractor or a doctor that's skilled or trained in alternative medicine will do. Which is wrong, which is right, that's what you have to look into. Neither is always right in most cases or always wrong. What about financial credentials? There are also no guarantee of financial success or an individual's integrity, but you can look into their past track record and in looking at that track record add to their credentials. Even ministerial ordination can be very subjective. You can get a different opinion from various ministers. You can't just go to one just because he's your local pastor. I've spent this past week, 3 hours or more on the phone with more than one person from various parts of the country calling and asking for counsel, which I appreciate the fact that they would even reach out and would do so. They're looking for a multitude of counselors and wisdom. Also, not all ministers see things all the same way. God is teaching us all and leading us all, but our abilities to teach it, our experience and our background may be more helpful than others. And I've heard this before as well. I heard a woman telling me once that the minister told her who to marry. Can anyone tell you who to marry? I mean, they could tell you. Do you have to obey a parent or a minister who says you should marry this person? I mean, I can't even imagine that coming out of my mouth, either as a minister or a parent. But someone told me that. So she was transferring the blame, onto someone else. I don't see that. You have to sort out, in all these cases, those who know what they're talking about from those who really don't. How would you do that in a ministerial case? Well, it's right here. Is what they're telling you in here. Because that's really all a minister is supposed to do. I'm not supposed to find you a job. I'm not supposed to find you a mate. I'm not supposed to fix your problems for you. I'm supposed to point you to what God says in his word about the situation that you're in and give you counsel and guidance from what his word says. And that's the kind of minister you should seek out, not one who just wants to give you his opinion or his past experience. And then lastly, number four, seek advice from someone who is likely to disagree with you. This is often one of the most difficult things there is to do. You don't have to do what they advise you to do, but you should hear them. If you only ask people who are likely to agree with you, you're not seeking counsel. You're looking for a confirmation for your own opinion and the way you want to go. A good counselor will be willing to say what you may not want to hear, but that you need to hear. Even a good friend will do that. And I see that lost today in many of what we call friendships in today's world. Oh, I would have told him not to do that, but I didn't want to hurt our friendship. You know what? A good friend will risk their friendship with you to give you advice you need to hear. And then after you stumble and fail because you didn't do it, then you can look back and see who your friends were. Those who were trying to help you, or those who were like walking away and letting you do something that will hurt you. You know, JFK, I read this quote someplace. I think I have a book on JFK. He was talking to Bobby Kennedy about his staff, his cabinet. And Bobby wanted to get rid of Pierre Salinger. Pierre Salinger was his press secretary at the time. And Bobby said, we should get rid of him. And JFK said, why? He says, because he never agrees with us. He's always bringing in the other side of the coin here. He's always speaking negatively against us, and we can't move forward. He puts these ideas in the rest of the cabinet's minds, and we get bogged down, and we can't get anything accomplished. JFK said, no. I need to hear the other side of this story. I need to understand what the consequences of my decisions are going to be, good and bad. And I want the rest of my council to hear it too, my staff. That's wisdom. And there's wisdom in that kind of counsel because it provides safety. After we've found a good counselor, it can be a struggle at times to learn to know which advice we're supposed to follow. I'd like to look at a couple of examples here. First, back in 2 Samuel 15, we'll read verses 10 through 15. This is the example of one of David's wisest counselors, Ahithophel. I'll give you some background here. In 2 Samuel 11:3, you can just write this down. 2 Samuel 11:3, it says that Bathsheba was the daughter of Eliam, and that Eliam was the son of Ahithophel. So Bathsheba was Ahithophel's granddaughter. And interestingly enough, Ahithophel was Solomon's great-grandfather, which may be some of what God put into Solomon to be receptive to the gift of wisdom he gave. David's sin with Bathsheba and Uriah appears to be the reason that Ahithophel turned against David here and sided with Absalom. Sin has many unforeseen consequences, but Absalom didn't recognize good advice when he heard it, and that's what we're reading here in 2 Samuel 15, verses 10 through 15. Then Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom reigns in Hebron. And with Absalom went 200 men invited from Jerusalem, and they were all they went along innocently and did not know anything. So Absalom, this is David's sons, one of them is rebelling against his father. Then Absalom sent for Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor, from his city, from Gilo. While he offered sacrifices and the conspiracy grew strong, for the people with Absalom continually increased in number. One of the reasons Absalom rebelled was because of the poor way that David handled the situation with his sister earlier. And he may have known and understood that Ahithophel would not side with David here because of what David did. Verse 13, now a messenger came to David saying, the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. Right after this reference to Ahithophel being sent for. And so David sent to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, arise and let us flee, or we shall not escape from Absalom. Make haste to depart, lest he overtake us suddenly and bring disaster upon us and strike the city with the edge of the sword. And the king's servants said to the king, we are your servants, ready to do whatever my lord the king commands. But Ahithophel was not ready to do this. Look at verses 30 through 37. So David went up by the ascent of the Mount of Olives and wept as he went up and as he had his head covered and went barefoot. Here he's being kind of cast out of the city and has to flee. And all the people who were with him covered their heads and went up weeping as they went. And someone told David, saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, O Lord, I pray, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. He was one of David's best counselors, one of the wisest men in Israel. And this scared everybody, the fact that Ahithophel would be at Absalom's side. Verse 32, now it happened when David had come to the top of the mountain where he worshipped God, there was Hushai, the Archite, coming to meet him with his robe torn and dust on his head. David said to him, if you go on with me, then you will become a burden to me. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king, as I was your father's servant previously, so I will now also be your servant, then you may defeat the council of Ahithophel for me. This is what David was hopeful for. He understood the pride and arrogance within Absalom. He understood that if another one of David's servants was coming to him, somebody that was even more loyal, and he was turning against him toward Absalom, that he might be able to turn the counsel of Ahithophel. This, on David's part, was wise. Verse 35, and do you not have Zadok and Abiathar the priests with you here? Therefore, it will be that whatever you hear from the king's house, that you should tell Zadok and Abiathar the priests. Indeed, they have there with them their two counselors, Ahimaaz, Zadok's son, and Jonathan, Abiathar's son, and by them you shall send me everything you hear. So Hushai, David's friend, went into the city, and Absalom came to Jerusalem. Look at chapter 16 now here, verse 20. We'll read on from verse 20. Then Absalom said to Ahithophel, give advice as to what we should do. And Ahithophel said to Absalom, go into your father's concubines, whom he has left to keep the house, and all Israel will hear that you are abhorred by your father. Then the hands of all who are with you will be strong. So they pitched a tent for Absalom on the top of the house, and Absalom went into his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. Now the advice of Ahithophel, which he gave in those days, was if one had inquired at the oracle of God. Notice that statement. Go to Ahithophel. It was like talking to somebody who was teaching you the oracles of God. But in Ahithophel's mind and heart, a root of bitterness had seeped in, and that caused weakness in his ability, at least, to share his counsel. So was all the advice of Ahithophel, both with David and with Absalom. Chapter 17, let's read through verse 14 here. Moreover, Ahithophel said to Absalom, now let me choose 12,000 men, and I will arise and pursue David. Notice this is Ahithophel that wanted to lead this group. Tonight, I will come upon him while he is weary and weak and make him afraid, and all the people who are with him will flee, and I will strike only the king. Then I will bring back all the people to you when all the return except the man whom you seek, but the people will be at peace. And the saying pleased Absalom and all the elders of Israel. And Absalom said, now call Hushai the Archite, and let us hear what he says too. This is where Hushai was left there by David to turn Ahithophel's counsel, at least in Absalom's eye. Verse 6, And when Hushai had come to Absalom, Absalom spoke to him, saying, Ahithophel has spoken in this manner. Shall we go up as he says? If not, speak up. So Hushai said to Absalom, the advice that Ahithophel has given is not good at this time. He knew it was good. He knew this is when you're supposed to hit him early on, before they got settled, before they got defenses built, before other resources, men and so on, could come and gather with David. For said Hushai, you know your father and his men, that they are mighty men, that they are enraged in their minds, like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. And your father is a man of war and will not camp with the people. Surely by now he is hidden in some pit or some other place. And it will be that when some of them are overthrown at the first, that whoever hears it will say there is a slaughter among the people who follow Absalom. And even he who is valiant, whose heart is like the heart of a lion, will melt completely. For all Israel knows that your father is a mighty man, and those who are with him are valiant men. Therefore I advise that all Israel be fully gathered to you, from Dan to Beersheba. Now notice how he's playing to his ego here. Like the sand that is by the sea for the multitude, and that you go to battle in person, so we will come upon him in some place where he may be found, and we will fall on him as the dew falls on the ground, and of him and all the men who are with him, there shall not be one left so much as one. He's buying time for David. Verse 13, moreover, if he is withdrawn into a city, then all the Israel shall bring ropes to that city, and we will pull it into the river until there is not one small stone found there. And I could see him saying this in some sense of almost pride and arrogance. So Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the advice of Hushai the Archite is better than the advice of Ahithophel, for the Lord proposed to defeat the good advice of Ahithophel to the intent that the Lord might bring disaster on Absalom. This is interesting how this was turned. God is answering David's prayer, and Ahithophel's response is really interesting. Verse 15, then Hushai said to Zadok and Abiathar, the priests, thus and so Ahithophel advised Absalom and the elders of Israel, and thus and so I have advised. Now therefore send quickly and tell David, saying, spend this night in the plains of the wilderness, but speedily cross over, lest the king and all the people who are with him be swallowed up. Now Jonathan and Ahimaaz stayed in Enrogel, and they dared not be coming into the city, so a female servant would come and tell them, and they would go and tell David. So David had his spies in place. Look at verse 23 now. Now when Ahithophel saw that his advice was not followed, he saddled a donkey and rose and went home to his house, to his city. Then he put his household in order and hanged himself and died. And he was buried with his father's tomb. Why did Ahithophel hang himself? Arrogance? Pride? A man that wise, speaking even as oracles of God would speak? Well, he knew that his advice was right. And he knew that Hushai's was wrong. Probably knew that Hushai was working for David. Absalom didn't see that, though. Being only one day in power, he didn't learn anything about being king. And Ahithophel knew that he would soon die as a result. He knew that Absalom would die as a result. He also knew that Absalom, once he was defeated, would have to answer to David for treason, and he did not want to have to do the same thing. He knew it was over. He knew it was over. And we know why he did it. Look at another example here. 1 Kings 12, verses 1 through 20. It's another example of an individual coming into kingship without an understanding of how to apply wisdom or who to look to for counselors and the damage that was done here. This is an example of Rehoboam. Rehoboam was Solomon's son, and when he began to reign, there was this issue, a tax issue, between the Israelites and the king. Solomon had taxed them very heavily, and they were asking for a little bit of relief. Chapter 12, verse 1. And Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all the Israel had gone to Shechem to make him king. So it happened when Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, heard it, he was still in Egypt, for he had fled from the presence of King Solomon and dwelling in Egypt, so that they had sent and called him. Then Jeroboam, who was not assigned king, although he was part of the line, Jeroboam and all the whole assembly of Israel came and spoke to Rehoboam, saying, this is what they were asking for. And the results of this were devastating for them. They never really recovered from it. Verse 4, your father made our yoke heavy. Now, therefore, lighten the burdensome service of your father and his heavy yoke which he put on us, and we will serve you. All he would have had to do is scale back somewhat. And it doesn't seem as though that was the issue here. The issue he saw, as his friends advised him here, was that they were kind of challenging his authority. Verse 5. So he said to them, depart for 3 days and then come back to me. And the people departed. Now he seeks counsel. Then King Rehoboam consulted the elders who stood before his father. These are individuals with experience, with background, with understanding, who guided and counseled his father Solomon while he still lived. How would you like to be a counselor to the wisest man who ever lived? At least they would have learned something from him, I would think. And he said, how do you advise me to answer these people? And they spoke to him, saying, if you will be a servant to these people today and serve them and answer them and speak good words to them, then they will be your servants forever. But he rejected the advice which the elders had given him and consulted the young men who had grown up with him. Interesting, he became king when he was 41 years old. So his friends, would have been the same age if they grew up with him, also stood before him. So these are not inexperienced people, but maybe people who felt overshadowed by their fathers and their fathers in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, wanted to make a name for themselves. Maybe he had the same intent. And he said to them, what advice do you give? How would we answer this people who have spoken to me, saying, lighten the yoke which your father put on us? Then the young men who had grown up with him spoke to him, saying, thus you shall speak to this people who have spoken to you, saying, your father made our yoke heavy, but you make it lighter on us. Thus you shall say to them, my little finger shall be thicker than my father's waist. what result would you expect from that response? We talk about authority, as the Bible describes it all the time, as being serving, as Christ defined it, and set the example. We make ourselves a slave when we take on a position of authority. It's about caring for others. It's about taking on their burden and helping them. This is the world's view of authority. Verse 11, "And now, whereas my Father put a heavy yoke on you, I will add to your yoke. My Father chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scourges." I'm going to rip the flesh off of you. What would you expect? Do you think they were going to just fear and kowtow? Verse 12. So Jeroboam and all the people came to Rehoboam the third day as the king had directed, saying, "Come back to me the third day." It's interesting that they were all kind of gathered around Jeroboam in the first place. Wisdom would have seen they're already organized. They already have a plan. Verse 13, "And then the king answered the people roughly and rejected the advice which the elders had given him. He spoke to them according to the advice of the young men, saying, 'My father made your yoke heavy, but I will add to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scourges.' So the king did not listen to the people, for the turn of events was from the Lord." We talked about this during the Holy Days, how God hardens people's hearts. Hearts are already prone to being hardened. And he just allowed it to go there. The turn of events was from the Lord, that he might fulfill in his word which he had spoken by Ahijah the Silonite to Jeroboam the son of Nebat. "Now when all Israel saw that the king did not listen to them, the people answered the king, saying, 'What share have we in David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse.'" Remember, they were already split when David took the throne. It took 7 years before Israel came together with Judah and had that joint unified peace for a short period of time under his reign and his son Solomon for 40 years. "To your tents, O Israel. Now see to your own house, O David." So Israel departed to their tents. But Rehoboam reigned over the children of Israel, who dwelt in the cities of Judah only. Again, in both of these cases, good advice was given, but not heeded. Good kings and priests know that they need good advice and good advisors, but they know which advice to listen to. Look at Proverbs 1. The way they understand that good advice is been told them and that they can act on it is they compare it to Scripture. And they approach it humbly, looking for guidance instead of looking for ways to manipulate or get ahead or take in any way. Proverbs 1, verses 1 through 7. "The Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel." Again, wisest man who ever lived outside of Christ. "To know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, judgment, and equity." Got to get my slides up to date here. Did my computer turn off? Have I been talking that long? It's on it? I'm good? Oh, yeah, it's in small print. It's still not turning, though. Allie, my clicker's broken. Allie loves my clicker. She kept trying to take it out of my hands at winter camp a couple of years ago. All right. "To perceive the words of understanding, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, judgment, and equity, to give prudence to the simple." Notice that. "To the young man, knowledge and discretion. A wise man will hear and increase learning. And a man of understanding will attain wise counsel." What is the makeup of an individual who will grow in wisdom? Certainly not arrogance. Certainly not pride. Certainly not this attitude that I don't need any help, I know it all, I'm better than you. A wise man will hear and increase learning, and a man of understanding will attain counsel. "To understand a proverb and an enigma, the words of the wise and their riddles. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction." We just saw an example of that. Fools despising instruction, despising wisdom, and they sought their own heart. They sought to feed their own egos. Young people are usually unaware how much they don't know. And again, youth can be a very dangerous time of life. I was listening to a sermon last night, an individual in Dallas, someone I knew when he was a young man. And he was giving a sermon on facing your life's decisions. You know the quote that I quoted? It's my quote. I stole something from a phrasing from Winston Churchill. But the quote goes like this. Winston Churchill said, "We build our houses, and then our houses build us," something to that effect. Because when you live in the house, it changes your living patterns and so on. I said, "We make our decisions, and then our decisions make us." You have to live with the decisions you make, and they affect your life. Thing is, some mistakes you never stop paying for. You need safety when you're in your youth. You need to recognize you need help and guidance and counseling. You also need to know how to choose those counselors, and you need to know which advice to follow, that which mirrors the Word of God. Never underestimate the power of parental advice, number one, but the advice of those in this room that can help you with so many things, because we've all been there, and we've made the mistakes we don't want to see you make. This verse 5, "Let the wise listen and add to their learning, and let the discerning get guidance." Who are the discerning? Fools despise wisdom and instruction. It says that in verse 7. They look down on it. And that's much of what we see in this day and age. When they need help, they don't even realize it, so they don't seek it. This is the essence of pride, ignorance, stubbornness. And these are all signs of the fool. Read the book of Proverbs. This is what fools do. Look at Proverbs 8 now, verses 12 through 21. Proverbs 8 and verse 12. "I, wisdom, dwell with prudence and find out knowledge and discretion. The fear of the Lord is to hate evil, pride and arrogance and the evil way, and the perverse mouth I hate. Counsel is mind and sound wisdom. I am understanding. I have strength. By me kings reign and rules decree justice. By me princes rule and nobles and all the judges of the earth. I love those who love me, and those who seek me diligently will find me. Riches and honor are with me, enduring riches and righteousness. My fruit is better than gold, yes, than fine gold, and my revenue than choice silver. I traverse the way of righteousness in the midst of the paths of justice, that I may cause those who love me to inherit wealth, that I may find their treasuries." All the money in the world's not going to mean a thing to you if you don't know how to manage it. Too many lottery winners have lost everything they had and are now completely flat out broke. Absalom was king for a day or two, maybe. Rehoboam lasted 17 years, but they were all unhappy. They were all oppressive. It started off with division within his early days. Solomon, even with all his faults, was king for 40 peaceful years because of his wisdom. And Jesus Christ's reign, as we talked about this morning, will last forever. And if we are to reign with him, we have much to learn. All right, now I really do need to change this, and it's not going. Can somebody hit my arrow? Why is it stuck? A wise man once told me that good speakers don't use PowerPoint. Ah, and this is why. Didn't follow his advice. Okay, number 4, we have to take responsibility for the decision, the final decision. Once we've been given good advice and we're in a mindset where we can actually receive it, we've got to be willing to take responsibility for the final decision. I talked to you about the woman that I spoke to who, even after years after her divorce, does not take accountability for the choice that she made and was putting it off on someone else. However good the advice, for adults anyway, the final decision is always ours. We can't expect good advisors to make the decision for us. Does that say good advisors or God advisors? Well, that's what we're going to be, God advisors. That's another reason not to use PowerPoint, because everybody sees your spelling errors. Don't expect a good advisor to make the decision. I have counseled with people who have had a pattern of that in the past with ministers, and I just sat there and listened. And I pointed out the scriptures to them, and I could tell they were frustrated. And I could tell after half an hour to an hour, they realized they weren't going to get, I wasn't going to make the decision for them. But I just pointed them to the scriptures and say, decision's yours. And they got up and walked away, and I could tell they were thinking, what a lousy minister this guy is. He didn't tell me what I was supposed to do. I'm not here to tell you what you're supposed to do. I'm here to tell you what the Word of God says. Don't expect a good advisor to make the decision. We have to live with the results. That's the only way we learn. And this life is all about learning. We have to make the decision ourselves. Adam and Eve in Genesis 3, I'll just mention this, they made the decision to eat from the wrong tree. But what happened after them, after God made his appearance? He confronted them. What did they do? They justified themselves. And they blamed someone else. Everyone blamed somebody else. They kept pointing the finger to someone else. And they found that the society that we live in today, it's a self-justifying, blaming society. It's filled with accusations and claiming victim status. This is, we're filled with it today. It's replete in this world. Jesus Christ came to bring a new society that heeds the words of the Father and of himself. Look at Matthew 7 here. Matthew 7, verses 24 through 29. Christ here is talking about enduring storms. And the wise will recognize that there are storms coming. And I'm not talking about wind and rain and clouds and lightning and thunder. And neither was he. Matthew 7, verse 24. He's talking prior to this about recognizing the people that he sends. He's saying, by their fruits shall you know them. And he goes into this statement, therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock. This goes for those who would seek out advice and counsel and do it, and those who are actually skilled enough to give it. They should be standing on a rock. And I don't mean a big piece of cement. I mean the rock. Verse 25, and the rain descended and the floods came and the winds blew and beat on the house and it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. But everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rain descended and the floods came and the winds blew and beat on that house and it fell, and great was its fall. Christ's words make us storm-proof. And that's the essence of safety in a stormy world. But we have to anticipate and prepare for those storms, brethren, that will attack us in all the decisions we've made in life relative to our decision to obey and follow God, buying cars, buying houses, making marriage proposals and vows, having children, knowing who to go to for counsel and how to apply that counsel. Jesus taught that the meek will inherit the earth. That should be us. But the meek are willing to listen. Willing to listen. They're wanting to listen to advice. They are not wise in their own eyes. Let's close here in Psalm 33. Psalm 33, we'll read verses 8 through 22. It's talking about the nations here and how they make plans in vain. I hope we're not doing that. I hope that we recognize that the plans that God has laid out for us in terms of Christ's return, the establishment of his kingdom, and every choice and decision that we will make in this life between now and then, we need to recognize that we cannot make our plans in vain. This is Psalm 33, verse 8. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him, for he spoke and it was done. He commanded and it stood fast. The Lord brings the counsel of the nations to nothing. He makes the plans of the peoples of no effect. The counsel of the Lord stands forever, the plans of his heart to all generations. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, the people he has chosen as his own inheritance. The Lord looks from heaven. He sees all the sons of men. From the place of his dwelling, he looks on all inhabitants of the earth. He fashions their hearts individually. He considers all their works. No king is saved by the multitude of an army. A mighty man is not delivered by great strength. A horse is a vain hope for safety. neither shall it deliver any by its great strength. Behold, the eye of the Lord is on those who fear him, on those who hope in his mercy, to deliver their soul from death and to keep them alive in famine. Our soul waits for the Lord. He is our help and our shield. For our heart shall rejoice in him because we have trusted in his holy name. Let your mercy, O Lord, be upon us, just as we hope in you. The nations make plans in vain because they do not follow the Lord. They do not fear the Lord. We must. Otherwise, our plans will also be fatally flawed in this age and in our failure to prepare for the age to come. God's counsel stands forever. His plans to all generations, as this proverb says. He is our chief counselor. When all is said and done, brethren, we can certainly choose to take the blows, as the song says, and do it our way. Or we can heed the word of God and wisely seek advice, counsel that he provides us. Christ's disciples will understand how important it is to seek good counsel. Above all, to seek the counsel of the living God in all their plans and in all their decisions.